today. Why are people risking their lives to cross the channel in dinghies?
C'est une macabre découverte qui a été faite ce matin sur la plage de Sangatte, non loin de Calais. Le corps d'un migrant a en effet été retrouvé selon les premiers...
On Wednesday morning, the body of a young Sudanese man was found on the beach of Sangatte, near Calais in northern France. It's been reported that French officials have named him as Abdel Fattah Hamdallah. He had attempted to cross the channel in a tiny dinghy, using two shovels as makeshift oars. The journey, which is around 20 miles long, would have been impossible in such a small boat. More and more people are now taking this dangerous route to the UK. The number of migrants arriving in boats this year is already double that of 2019. But behind these numbers are men, women and children, escaping war, disaster and poverty, hoping that this will be the final leg of a perilous journey. But if they do make it to the UK, they find themselves in a country with a government that is becoming increasingly hostile to new arrivals. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, who are the people risking everything to cross the channel?
We were working with a photographer. He was formerly a refugee and he now takes photos of refugees in Calais and Dunkirk.
Harriet Grant is a reporter for The Guardian.
And he called me and said that he'd been out on his bike when he'd seen a large group of people, many of them without any shoes on. They were still wet. They'd obviously made an attempted crossing of the sea, but it had failed.
And they asked me, how do you speak Parsi? And I say, oh yeah, I Parsi, and they say, we was going in the boat, and the boat, it's drowned. The boat was supposed to, they say, like, maybe maximum 50 people or something. They put 80 people. Most of them, they don't know how to swim.
He said there was a pregnant woman, there's someone with a two-year-old, there were children, and he stopped to talk to them. And in fact, when I spoke to him, he said, I've got to go. I've said, I'll buy them all some sandwiches. So he just handed the phone to a woman he'd found who spoke English.
You can speak to her.
Okay.
Because we're one group and I'm going to supermarket to bring them something to eat.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Hello, yeah, I can hear you.
Thank you for speaking to me. Can I ask you some questions?
Of course.
So could you tell me what happened this morning?
We were too much people. Also, it took water. Our boat took water too much.
How far did you get into the sea before the boat had problems?
Maybe not 100 meters. The police didn't come. We called the emergency police. They didn't come to take us.
Were you afraid?
Yes, of course. It was terrifying.
Water started to come in, a child went overboard, was luckily pulled back in.
Oh, yeah.
So how are the children and families now?
We are all wet and terrified.
She still sounded quite overwrought from the experience. Yeah, she genuinely felt her life was at risk and those of the people with her, and to her it seemed an incredibly dangerous thing to do.
And who is she? You know, what did you find out about her?
Well, interestingly, she was Turkish. She was a woman. The majority of the people pass through Calais are men, although women and families do come through on that route. She was on her own, which is not easy for a woman to travel alone. You're at a lot of risk from the smugglers, from ending up sleeping rough on the street. And she told me she was an academic. I won't say too much about what she taught because she is worried about it revealing her identity. And everybody on this route worries of that then being recognised back at home or when they claim asylum here. So she's an academic. She said she's an enemy of the government. And if you're an enemy of the government because you don't agree with them in Turkey, you're at risk of being imprisoned.
Why did you leave Turkey?
Because
big, sorry, big question.
If you are against Erdogan, it's terrible. You are terrorists. We don't have another choice. We cannot go back to our country. So maybe they will kill us, or for sure, if I go, they will put me in jail. I don't know for how long time. And I don't want to lose my future. I came here to start a new life. But today, it was terrible.
Will you try again in the boats?
Never.
Never. What will you do now?
I don't know. I have to find another way.
You still will try to reach the UK?
Yes.
I'm so sorry for this situation.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
So the woman you've spoken to then is stuck in Calais, a place that I think many people might remember from a few years ago as having established camps known as the jungle, where refugees would stay while they tried to make the crossing to the UK. Those camps have been shut down since. But you were in Calais recently. What's it like there now?
People are sleeping rough. There's a petrol station where men sleep literally surrounded by rubbish in the heat by the side of the road. If they're lucky, they have a sleeping bag. Their skin's getting burnt. A guy came up to us and was asking for cream because I was with somebody from a charity. He was saying his arm was getting burnt.
Oh,
I mean,
God.
There are people that have absolutely nothing. During lockdown, very little remained in terms of support, but one of the groups there, health refugees, were telling me how they had to deliver water. There's no running water. It's almost hard to imagine a situation where there is absolutely no infrastructure. There'd be people there that haven't washed for months.
Oh, my God.
Any attempts to form any sort of camps, the police come in and they rip the tents up and they move people on. There's a zero tolerance attitude to allowing anything like the jungle to spring up again.
And who is there at the moment? Tell me about some of the people that you met.
Well, there are a lot of people of Kurdish nationality. I met a lot of Sudanese people, and there are always lots of Afghans. You know, these are people from well-known trouble spots in the world. They're people who've fled tension, conflict, severe poverty. As I was at the food distribution, two women walked up. A mother and a daughter, and the daughter was only 15, and they were Sudanese. And I said to them, how long have you been travelling until you got here from when you left Sudan? And the girl said, 5 years.
5 years.
And 5 years, she's just sort of, you feel she's reached this end point in Calais. It's the end of the road. It's where people come when they've exhausted other options.
The argument often made against migrants claiming asylum in the UK is that under EU law, they're usually expected to do this in the first EU country they set foot in. As you say, many people in Calais have been through European countries on the way there. So why specifically do they want to get to the UK?
A lot of people in Calais have been refused asylum elsewhere in Europe. Or they've had a very bad experience elsewhere in Europe, like being beaten. There's well-documented human rights abuses of migrants in Eastern Europe in particular, in countries like Croatia and Hungary. I think what's really important is to look at Europe as a whole. So when you hear people on phone-in radio shows or on Twitter, and I've read a lot of this recently, say, oh, they're coming from war-torn France, are they? You've got to really understand the context of seeking asylum in Europe. If you arrive in Italy and everyone you meet from the Sudanese community is homeless and has been waiting 2 years for their refugee claim to be heard, or if you meet people who have been given refugee papers and then put back on the street because there is literally no housing, no work, there's no opportunities, or if you're in Greece and you're living in a camp, it just doesn't seem like a fair system that you should want to stay. And it's not that people are fleeing conflict and tension in Europe, it's that they want to build a new life.
This is good.
It's better.
That's very good.
Hell, man.
Some people who attempt the Channel crossing are able to build a new life in the UK. And last week, Harriet went to meet an Iranian family who are now living in North London. They sat together and spoke through a translator.
We would like to hear about the experience from somebody who has reached the UK.
خیلی خوب من در خدمتم هر سوالی داشته باشه با.
I'm at your service. Any question that you have, you can ask and I will answer.
This family is dad, mum, and at the time they had two boys, one who's actually going into year five now in the UK. They come from the Kurdish part of Iran where they say their lives were increasingly becoming very, very difficult because of prejudice against Kurdish people in Iran. And the father said it just became unbearable. His children couldn't learn properly in school because there was prejudice against them. He couldn't work properly. He didn't feel safe there.
من با یکی از احزاب سیاسی کرد در ایران
I've been in touch with one of the Kurdish political person. The government understood they wanted to catch me. If they've catched me, I will dead. My life was in danger and I didn't have any other chance. I must leave my country.
Their youngest son is severely autistic. When I met him, I thought it must have been so difficult for them and for him to cross in the boat. And the mother was in fact pregnant when they made the crossing. She since had her baby who I met when I went to visit with them.
Gosh, how did they get to France? And what was that journey like for them?
So they made a journey, which a lot of people make. They came overland from Iran into Europe.
ما در ایران با مشکلات زیادی روبرو شدیم با ترس و وحشت که از ایران اومدیم بیرون با قاچاق برات.
They say we had a very dark days during this journey. Me and my family have been forced to sleep in the forest, in the jungles for so many days, and we took shower with the cold water. And also, one time, the smuggler tried to transfer us with the lorry, and we were in the lorry, and we had problem with for breathing. We were very near to die in that time, he said.
At one point, he described nearly dying in a lorry. Again, something that I heard quite often when speaking to us, to migrants, that they had bad experiences in some of the vehicles they got into. He told me afterwards, actually sent me a message to say that when he was in Croatia, he was badly beaten by border guards, something which is not uncommon. And I've met other people that have reported that happening.
Gosh. So a very traumatic journey. Can you tell me about their boat crossing?
Well, the boat crossing sounded very harrowing.
شاید باور نکنید. شاید دوباره میگم باور نکنید. ولی قایق ما...
They say the boat, at the first moment that we wanted to start to cross, had a problem. And there was a hole on the boat. And we did it.
You made it. How long at sea?
یه ناسوس بهمون دادن یه طلبه بهمون دادن گفتید دیگه تو راه خودتون پر کنید.
They said they gave us a pump and said if there was a problem just pump it up.
And how many hours did it take to cross?
تقریبا 14 ساعت طول کشید.
They say it takes about 14 hours.
Wow.
He said it was extremely frightening. The children were scared. His wife was scared. When you're pregnant, obviously, you're trying to take better care of yourself. I said to them, how your son, who has autism, how did he cope with the journey?
Sorry.
He just said, sometimes you just have no choice and you have to do something very, very difficult. But what I think is interesting about their story is from the moment they arrived in the UK, it was a very positive experience for them. They were incredibly glad to land and said they were treated very well once they arrived.
بله واقعا همه شوکه شده بودیم، ترسیده بودیم، خیلی سرد بود.
We were afraid, we were freezing because of the weather and we were shocked. But when we arrived to Dover and they had a very good behavior and they show respect to us and they tried to make the babies especially happy
and they make fun with them. They try to make them laugh and make them happy. We felt very better and we felt very good because of that.
I think it really puts into perspective why people, whether you think this is concerning or whether you think it means the British system is fairer than others, how driven people feel to reach the UK, because that is truly an incredibly dangerous and frightening thing to do with your children and your pregnant wife.
What has life been like for this family since they arrived here?
Well, actually, it was nice to meet a family who felt they were being treated well. I went to their house in North London and I saw the primary school where their son was at school, and they live in a council estate in a flat they've kept absolutely immaculate, and they don't get a huge amount of money to live on, but they're very happy, very grateful.
And how much money do they get a week?
You get £37.75 for every person in your household, about £150 for a family of four. And you get a £3 extra a week if you have a baby under one, which they do. They did seem happy and their little boy had settled in well at school.
So, how old are you?
Nine.
So your parents let you play outside?
Yeah.
What sort of games?
Like football, hide and seek, something like that.
An interesting comparison with the children living in the camps of northern France is they're not in school. If you look at Greece and the Moria camp, not only are the children there not in school, there are no safe spaces there for children to play. So in amongst all the criticism of the UK's asylum policy, I think it's really important that we focus on the fact that when our system works, it works well and it's better than some other countries.
Have they applied for asylum in the UK? What's their situation now?
They've applied for asylum and they're waiting for the result.
After this, the UK government's increasingly hostile rhetoric towards asylum seekers. This is a family who are here now, but they've been forced to risk their lives crossing land and sea to get here, Harriet. Are there other options for people trying to reach the UK from other countries that mean they can come here more safely and begin a new life?
So this is very interesting. If you talk about how someone could follow the rules and still apply for asylum, the numbers are really minute. During the beginning of the refugee crisis in 2014-2015, the government committed to take 20,000 Syrian refugees direct from the Middle East. And we have now taken about that number, but that's over 5 years, a few thousand a year. There's a global resettlement scheme that resettles a handful of refugees to the UK. You can also apply to come here if you have family. There's also another smaller resettlement scheme that takes people not from Syria to complement the Syrian resettlement scheme that settles sort of a few thousand people over a few years. The fact is we're talking tiny numbers. When I was in Calais and I tweeted my story, I had many, many responses on Twitter from Iraqis living in Turkey waiting for resettlement. I had about 60 messages from people saying, please, please, will you look at the situation for us? We're waiting for the legal way. People in Britain are talking about people crossing illegally. But here we are, we're trying to do the right thing. And we've been waiting for years and years in a complete limbo because there are so few resettlement places for people to be moved directly from the camps to a safe country.
And is this going to become even more difficult after Brexit, you know, when we leave finally the beginning of next year?
Well, one of the impacts of Brexit is it looks like there will be no replacement for the European Family Reunion Law. Under EU law, you can apply to join an uncle or a cousin. And under the far, far more restricted British version, not only can you not apply to join relatives like that, you can apply to join parents or siblings, but they have to be British citizens. And that's a big leap. What the charities who work on these cases have said is most of the people who've come in recent years wouldn't be eligible.
Harriet, we've established that the number of migrants arriving in small boats is at an all-time high. But compared to other European countries, the amount of people coming to the UK is very low. Despite this, in the last couple of weeks, this has made front page news and reporters have been out on boats, trailing dinghies as they make their way to shore.
Yeah, you can see why it's dangerous today, because the sea is pretty choppy. And then we came across this boat around half an hour ago, just spotted it on the horizon. And we have seen them actually trying to get water out of the boat. They're doing that at the moment. They're using a plastic container just to try to bail out the boat. So obviously it's pretty overloaded there. People are wearing life jackets, but it is pretty dangerous, just the number of people on board that boat. Let me just see. Are you okay? Are you all right? Okay?
Okay.
Okay? Where are you from?
Syria.
How many people?
Why is this such a big story now?
Being honest, it is visually shocking to see boats full of people, including women and children, crossing the channel. And I think it would be strange if we didn't react to it quite strongly and if the media didn't go and report on it. Interestingly, I think Nigel Farage has driven some of this because he's been down there.
You can see the boats absolutely packed, all being charged a minimum of €5,000 each for the criminal gangs to make this crossing.
You might as well have a big sign on the White Cliffs of Dover over there that says anyone that comes to Britain illegally can stay. Australia faced this a few years ago. They dealt with it. They said anyone that comes with this route won't be allowed to stay. That is what we have to do as well.
That puts pressure on the government to respond, and they think, oh, we need to look like we're doing something. Obviously, there's been discussion around the fact that, are they trying to look tough on borders in the run-up to Brexit because they're going to be under pressure to control their borders when we said we're leaving the EU to control our borders. So if we're not, where does that leave us? But I actually think maybe a more simple answer is we're not used to seeing the people that arrive across the channel and now we're seeing them.
And what have the government been doing about this, Harriet, for the past couple of weeks?
Well, what we've seen is a really visible government presence down at the channel. They want to stop the crossings being viable. They want it to stop it being used by small boats. They've talked about bringing the Navy in. There's been a lot of pushback on that from human rights lawyers, even from people in the Navy themselves. Priti Patel has appointed this clandestine channel threat commander to tackle illegal attempts, illegal in government's words, illegal attempts to reach the UK. We've just seen multiple efforts to reframe this as a sort of assault on the UK that needs to be urgently tackled. Priti Patel says she wants to overhaul the asylum system in a way that's going to send the left into meltdown. There's been quite a lot of that in the last week, this diatribe really against human rights lawyers, against people that help asylum seekers fight deportation once they're here in the UK. That's something else the government's talked about quite a lot. This very interesting quote from Boris Johnson that didn't get as much attention as his criminal crossings quote. He said,
"We need to look at the legal framework that we have, all the panoply of laws that an illegal immigrant has at his or her disposal that allow them to stay here, and we need to look at what we can do to change that."
I mean, it's such an interesting way to frame the relationship between an asylum seeker and the state. He made it sound as though it's the asylum seeker who has all the power, and he wants to give that impression.
And we know asylum seekers don't have all the power. As The Guardian has reported recently, the Home Office has been arranging deportations of vulnerable asylum seekers, people who are torture survivors and are suffering with PTSD. Last week, a flight carrying 14 people took off for France and Germany. But some people still keep making the journey across the channel, a journey that some politicians, as you say, have described as illegal. But is it?
It's true that the actions of the smugglers are criminal. However, it's not against the law to cross a border irregularly to seek asylum. In fact, you're actually protected under international refugee law and the Geneva Convention. You can't be punished for travelling without documents or travelling irregularly if your purpose is to seek asylum. And I think people in government know that, and I think it's a deliberate muddying of the waters.
feels to me, Harriet, like this is a vicious cycle. You know, we've spoken about smugglers and some of the abuses they carry out, but they wouldn't do that unless there was a demand for their work. And as long as it's very difficult for somebody to legitimately apply for asylum, people will be forced to come here in whatever way they can. What might be some of the solutions to breaking that cycle?
Between someone leaving Syria or Afghanistan and then reaching the UK, there are so many multiple points at which you could help and support them and try and stop them making the dangerous journey. First and foremost, more safe routes. Could people apply to come and join family in the UK from Lebanon or from Jordan or from Syria? Far more numbers of people were allowed to do that. It would reduce the number of people crossing Europe. It's been a problem for many years because there have been conflicts and wars and disasters for many years. And as long as those happen, there will be people trying to reach the UK. I do think that the UK government wants to do something quite radically different. I suspect that possibly they want to try and really, really reduce the number of people coming and claiming asylum.
The family you met have applied for asylum, but what might the future be like for them now?
If they stay, they'll hopefully be able to find work and support themselves and build a good life, as we know refugees have all over the world.
What were your thoughts when you walked away from that interview, Harriet, after you'd met them?
The thing I actually found most forlorn was their intense desire to express their gratitude to the Home Office. It's almost a level of fear. They sort of took the microphone and said, before you go, we want to say thank you, Home Office, thank you, British people.
واقعاً میخواستم از اینجا از مردم خوب اینجا تشکر کنم از هوم آفیس هم تشکر کنم واقعاً خیلی به ما
He say I want to appreciate from the people in UK and also Home Office and all the government, all the offices that are involved, and I want to be thankful and I want to appreciate of them. And I want to say that I love this place like my home. And I do respect to all of them.
And I'm sure it was sincere, but there's something sad about people feeling that their lives are so much in the hands of others.
Harriet, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Harriet Grant. Her reporting on this is part of a brilliant Guardian series called Human Rights in Focus. Read that and all her stories at theguardian.com. And do go back to listen to an episode we made with her earlier this year called Life on Lesbos, What's Happening to Refugees There? Today's episode was produced by Joshua Kelly and sound design was by Axel Kakutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. Thank you for listening this week, for your reviews, tweets and emails. Next week, all of us here at Today in Focus are taking a break. But while we're off, we're going to be revisiting 5 episodes about race, beginning on Monday with the death of George Floyd. Will anything change? We'll also be replaying a fascinating conversation between Nasheen Iqbal and the writer Rennie Edo-Lodge, which I really recommend. I hope you enjoy all the episodes and we'll be back a week on Monday.